This is an ABC podcast.
Hi, I'm Linda Mottram. In this episode, spare parts in short supply for Australia's new fighter jets. Can the financial regulator improve without new funding? And calls for drought-hit eastern states to embrace recycled water. Welcome to the program. For all of the efforts to combat the stigma around mental illness, frontline workers say that those who suffer are still not being treated as whole humans with a complex set of problems. And that's backed up by new research that quantifies just how much shorter the lives of those with severe mental illness can be. Those people can die up to 20 years earlier than the rest of the population because their mental illness causes and compounds other health issues that can literally kill them early. Our reporter Sarah Collard has been catching up with some of those who see these struggles daily.
Bondi Beach is famous for its pristine sandy beaches and seaside mansions housing the rich and famous. But there is another often overlooked side to this beachside suburb. Kim Bailey at Wayside Chapel sees some of the community's most vulnerable people who have fallen through the cracks. Can you give me a bit of an insight to what you see every day here?
Basically, it's a range of issues that people present with: homelessness, isolation, mental health, drug and alcohol. We're here to kind of support people to feel connected to community. And when people arrive here, we have no judgment and we just want to meet and see people as they are.
People like those Kim Bailey sees are far more likely to have mental health concerns and a history of trauma. Today, the Lancet Psychiatry Commission's global report has found that it's those very struggles that can shorten people's lives by as much as 20 years. The University of Sydney's Simon Rosenbaum, who worked on the report, says mental health and physical health must be tackled in tandem to improve well-being.
Regardless of the type of illness, so whether it's things like depression or anxiety or schizophrenia, the poor physical health of people living with mental illness is really regardless of the diagnosis itself. It just reiterates the fact that we really need to be prioritising physical health at the same time.
The research looked at over 100 cases and found that those living with mental health issues are much more likely to struggle with cardiovascular diseases, diabetes and obesity.
We were disheartened to see that, but the evidence is very clear and there's been, you know, an overwhelming amount of evidence for a long period of time now showing that people living with mental illness experience this disparity in physical health and ultimately in life expectancy.
Dr. Simon Rosenbaum says the research shows how important it is to take a holistic approach to health and wellness. Those suffering mental health concerns are much more likely to smoke, drink alcohol at risky levels, be inactive and have poor diet and sleeping habits.
It isn't just an individual issue. We've got to consider the social determinants of things like socioeconomic status, poverty, to really make sure that we can improve people's physical health regardless of those other factors.
But Dr. Simon Rosenbaum says it's not just lifestyle factors at play here. It's also about being able to access affordable, quality care.
This isn't just an individual issue. We've got to consider the social determinants of things like socioeconomic status, poverty, to really make sure that we can improve people's physical health regardless of those other factors.
Kim Bailey at the Wayside Chapel says sometimes the best way to close that gap is to have services come to them.
We have some in-reach clinics here. They're usually wary about going to health services, so we can support them physically by taking them there. But by having the health services come here, it's a safe space. And also they don't have to travel to a clinic. It's here.
Kim Bailey isn't surprised by the findings. It's something he sees every day.
Because they're on the streets and rough, sleeping in the elements, it takes its toll. So some people do look a good 10 to 15 years older than they actually are, which is quite surprising when we start to talk to them and get information around the date of birth and all of those kinds of things. But then when we hear their story, it's quite understandable.
Kim Bailey is with the charity The Wayside Chapel. Our reporter there was Sarah Collard. A senior US government audit official says Australia should be asking some serious questions about the global supply of spare parts for the Joint Strike Fighter aircraft because the system has significant problems. 12 countries, including Australia, have committed to purchase the troubled F-35. The fighter jets are finally being delivered to air forces around the world, including Australia's. But the global spare parts system is so problematic that a US audit has found aircraft were unable to fly on average 30% of the time. Speaking to Australian media for the first time, a senior official with the US Government Accountability Office has told PM the US Department of Defence, which owns all the spare parts, doesn't even know how many it has or where they are. Sarah Dingle has our report.
Over the years, the Joint Strike Fighter, or the F-35, has drawn plenty of criticism for its dramatic escalation in price and production time. Now, hundreds of the aircraft have been delivered worldwide, with plenty more to come. But the US Government Accountability Office is issuing a warning to partner nations.
The bottom line is, far too often the F-35 is sitting on the tarmac because there aren't enough spare parts.
That's Diana Maurer, a director at the US Government Accountability Office, an independent, publicly funded agency that investigates US federal spending. Diana Maurer and her team have delivered a landmark report on the F-35 program, not about its development, but about its logistics, how we can keep these planes flying as advertised. One contractor, Lockheed Martin, is delivering this plane to 12 countries. One of the big selling points of the F-35 is its interoperability. The fact that so many nations have the same aircraft is supposed to allow them to work better with allies and also achieve economies of scale. There's a single global pool of spare parts.
We currently have about 300 plus F-35s around the world. Most of those are in the US fleet. But a number of countries, including Australia, are starting to take delivery. And one of the things we noted in our report was that within the next 3 to 4 years, if the program stays on track, there'll be upwards of almost as many as 1,000 aircraft deployed globally, which means it's really important for the Joint Program Office and the F-35 program to address all the numerous problems we found with the global support network that's supposed to underlie the program.
How is it working currently?
It is not working as promised. In fact, we found some pretty significant problems with the global support system. First and foremost, there are not enough spare parts to go around. We found that on average, about 30% of the time, F-35s globally cannot fly because there are not spare parts to allow them to get up in the air and perform their mission. We found that there are not sufficient numbers of repair facilities to fix the parts in the aircraft when they need to be repaired. So more specifically, the initial plan to get those facilities set up is now about 8 years behind schedule and will not be completed until 2024. We also found that it's taking about 6 months on average to repair spare parts that need to be fixed. That is twice as long as initially planned. And we also found that the system and the network for moving parts around the different partner countries has also not been established.
The global pool of spares is governed by a complex intersection of interests. All spares are owned by the US Department of Defence, and they're apportioned to countries by Lockheed Martin, according to rules agreed by the partner nations.
Realistically, if there is a conflict and the US and a number of other partner nations are involved, like Australia, and there is heavy demand for a certain type of spare part for the F-35, the U.S. is going to take priority, isn't it?
You know, you would anticipate that as an outcome. That is definitely one issue to be really concerned about. I think more broadly, the fact that there are not enough spare parts available now in a time of relative peace. If we were in, we being the U.S. and Australia and other allies, were in combat with a common enemy, there would be significant and serious strain on the supply network that's available for the F-35.
In further concerning news for partner nations like Australia, Diana Maurer's team found that the US Department of Defence, although it's spent billions on spares for the F-35, isn't on top of what that money has bought. As it stands, does the US Defence Department know where the spares are for the F-35 and how many of them it has?
To put it simply, they do not.
I think that the GAO produces reports that are always accurate and well-researched. And so it is a real concern.
Dr. Malcolm Davis is a senior analyst in defence capability with the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. He says the F-35 is highly effective in combat and stealth, but it needs to be able to get airborne.
If it can't actually get off the ground because there's no spare parts or because the parts are in the wrong place at the wrong time, then it's not a very effective platform. So from an Australian perspective, who are operating 72 of the F-35As, we need to make sure that the sustainment of that platform is effective, and that means we need to work with the Americans to get these problems solved as soon as possible.
Diana Maurer says it's about properly supporting warfighters' needs.
When you do talk to pilots, this aircraft has tremendous capabilities. The people who fly them are very fond of the aircraft, but they're very frustrated with many other aspects of it as well. And it doesn't do anyone any good to spend hundreds of billions of dollars fielding a system that far too often is sitting on the ground.
The Australian National Audit Office published a report at the end of last year finding that effective ongoing maintenance, repair and support of Australia's F-35s largely depends on the US Department of Defence managing this global spares network. The ANAO declined to comment to PM.
And we've also put a series of questions to the Australian Defence Department on these matters. We're yet to receive a response. Sarah Dingle with that report. And more tomorrow on the next multi-billion dollar modernisation of the F-35. Appears that's going ahead without a complete business case.
And they're moving into a bunch of expensive, I think the what we noted was $10.5 billion program that is beginning right now that introduces new capabilities to the F-35s. They're estimating that cost to be $10.5 billion today, and we don't believe they have a very good business case.
That's on PM tomorrow. This is PM. We are broadcast and podcast, and we're on the ABC Listen app. I'm Linda Mottram. On Twitter, I'm at Linda Mottram. Ahead, Indigenous communities battle to find the graves of their loved ones that lie unmarked and unregistered in the thousands across the Northern Territory. The financial regulator APRA says it accepts all the recommendations of a sharply critical independent review, but it's asking how it can make the necessary changes without more government funding. The review was recommended by the Banking Royal Commission and was led by the former Competition and Consumer Commission head, Graham Samuel. It's been scathing about APRA's culture, recommending improvements. It also says the regulator should be tougher in cracking down on misconduct and should set up a specialised superannuation division. Samantha Donovan has our report.
APRA's track record in overseeing the nation's banking, insurance and superannuation institutions was slammed at the Banking Royal Commission. This independent review sees room for significant improvement on a number of fronts. APRA Chairman Wayne Byers.
Overall, the report provides a fair and balanced assessment of APRA and, importantly, a solid roadmap for the future.
Mr. Byers says most of the issues raised by the review have already been identified by APRA, like the need to communicate better with the community and enhance its workplace culture.
And indeed, the capability review emphasises that APRA is, notwithstanding recent budget increases, still a pretty lean regulator in terms of resourcing. So it's quite a challenge that's been posed, and we'll need to work with the government to determine how best we can meet the ambitious agenda that's been laid out for us.
The review made 19 recommendations for APRA and 5 for the federal government. Jane Hume, the Assistant Minister for Superannuation, Financial Services and Financial Technology, says the government will act. She's rejecting calls from some industry observers for Mr. Byers to stand down and thinks if APRA adopts all the recommendations, it'll have the power to do its job.
There is so much on the financial services legislative agenda that I can't guarantee that everything will be done and passed before the end of the year, but certainly our intention would be to make sure that APRA is appropriately funded, resourced and positioned so that it can do its job properly.
Jane Hume says APRA has been adequately resourced.
APRA have already had $150 million allocated to them in the 2019-2020 budget, and that's on top of $58.7 million that was allocated to them at the end of last year in November to allow them to appoint more frontline supervisory staff. Now, any additional funding that's required would be considered in the next round of the budget.
Labor says it supports the broad thrust of the review's recommendations. The Shadow Treasurer, Jim Chalmers.
The report has also made it clear that funding cuts to APRA over the life of this Liberal government has hampered its ability to crack down on bad behaviour and to properly supervise the banks.
Professor Ian Ramsey is the Director of the Centre for Corporate Law at Melbourne University. He thinks the review has made a number of significant recommendations for APRA.
I think one of the most important would be the need for a fundamental shift in the culture of APRA. APRA is referred to as an organisation that is not nimble, that needs to improve, that clearly has some significant issues with our staff morale and needs to be focusing upon new technologies, for example, issues such as cyber risk. And these new challenges that APRA faces means that its internal culture needs to change.
The reviews recommended that a new superannuation division be set up in APRA. How do you think that would change things?
What we would hope then, by establishing a new division with a new head and presumably focused resources, that that would ensure that that area then gets more dedicated attention, more focused expertise from APRA staff, better communication perhaps with the regulated industry, and therefore better protection for all of those in the workforce who of course have compulsory superannuation.
How does the review panel want APRA to change its oversight of the banks?
Clearly, APRA needs to step up in relation to enforcement and also communication of its basic mission to the broader community. When you have a strong regulator that is prepared to take strong enforcement action, that sends a powerful message out there to the regulated community in terms of deterrence.
Professor Ian Ramsey is from Melbourne University, speaking with Samantha Donovan. Staff at the CSIRO and Geoscience Australia were alarmed this week when the ABC revealed that mining company Adani had sought the names of scientists reviewing its contentious groundwater plans for the Carmichael coal mine so the company could check if they were anti-coal activists. The company said it just wanted to know it was being treated fairly. Names of individual scientists were not released. The company was told the review was the work of the agencies, not individuals. But the incident raised concerns about the potential intimidation of scientists. The Australian Academy of Science is another of this country's august institutions, providing scientific advice, promoting scientific engagement and championing excellence and an understanding of science. Professor David Day is the Secretary for Science Policy at the Academy. I asked him first whether he thought Adani was trying to intimidate scientists.
Look, I don't know whether they were being intimidated. That goes to the question of why Adani asked for this information. And I think the government department responded really well, saying this is a CSIRO geoscience report to the government and individual science should not be contacted.
What is the risk with this approach, though? I mean, arguably, a company or an individual or a government should be free to question whether there's bias in processes, surely.
They should. I think the way around that is for the process to be made completely transparent. So that means the methodology used should be made public. The Academy's view is whenever we do either a review or a survey or a report for somebody, that we make sure that the process is very rigorous. We publish what that is. We send the report out for independent peer review, and then we insist on making it public. So that provides transparency, and I think in terms of trusting the scientific advice, I think transparency is really important.
In matters of particular controversy, especially where politics has been involved, like mining is a good example of that, I suppose, so is climate energy, isn't it inevitable that scientists' expert views will be construed by some as biased, regardless of the process you may be transparent about?
Yes, but I think that reflects on the person who holds those views, not on the process. If the process is scientifically rigorous and the advice is independent and fellow experts agree with it, then I don't think individual biases will hold up if they're investigated.
There have been discussions, debates about whether agencies like CSIRO, for example, have faced political pressure to shape or constrain their work. I mean, how real are the pressures that scientists in agencies are facing from these different forces?
So that's difficult for me to answer because I don't work at CSIRO or any of those other agencies. As far as I'm aware, look, there's not political pressure specifically in these instances. I think there are constraints placed on bodies like CSIRO. So, for example, the funding envelope forces them to make choices about what they research and how they research it. And I think also when things like a report is commissioned or specific advice is sought, if the parameters are extremely narrowly defined, then that constrains what that agency can do. But personally, as far as I know, there's no direct political manipulation of that process.
But are all scientists equal, I guess, is the other question. You know, there are scientists who work for agencies with these rigors around their work, and then there are scientists who work for private companies, for-profit companies. Are they equal?
Well, in terms of their science ability, they probably are. I think it when a scientist is working for a for-profit company, and they are reporting on issues with directly related to that company's interests, then I think there's an additional onus on them to have really rigorous peer review and to make the methodology and the findings open. And that doesn't always happen, of course, with companies. So in that respect, the constraints on those scientists are different than they are in a public institution.
Professor David Day, thank you very much for your time.
Been a pleasure. Thank you.
Professor David Day from the Australian Academy of Science. As country towns across New South Wales and Queensland edge closer to running dry, running out of water, governments are trying to find ways to guarantee supply now and into the future. But on the opposite side of the country, the city of Perth is leagues ahead in its water efficiency. Perth has embraced an idea that's by no means new, but has tended to encounter some resistance: water recycling, making water that's flushed down the toilet and poured down the drain drinkable again. Bridget Fitzgerald has more.
2% of the water that comes out of Perth taps was once waste.
So we flush our loos, we have a shower, we use our washing machines, and it then gets processed.
Claire Luga is the communications manager at Perth's Water Corporation. She spent more than a decade convincing the public that recycled wastewater is perfectly safe to drink. But she doesn't shy away from the yuck factor.
So it's only a small percentage of the water that comes into the plant that's actually from our toilets. But getting over that perception, that kind of image that you might be drinking the water that you're flushing down the toilet, that was probably one of our big challenges initially.
After years of campaigns and education, the community is on board. Perth has been drinking recycled wastewater since late 2017. It's called groundwater replenishment. They take the treated wastewater, which would normally have been flushed back out into the ocean, they filter it again, and then it goes through reverse osmosis, almost like pushing the water through a big sponge. Then it's disinfected with ultraviolet light. And finally, it's pumped back underground into the natural aquifers.
And it becomes part of the natural groundwater system and eventually will be abstracted out as part of our drinking water.
Groundwater makes up about 40% of Perth's water supply. There's 50% desalinated water and about 10% from a dam. It's estimated recycled water constitutes about 2% of what comes through the taps. But that will double in coming months when a new plant comes online. And why has Perth gone to all this trouble? Quite simply, it was running out of water.
We know from the mid-70s onwards, Perth's rainfall has been declining by about 20%, and that's had a huge impact on our water sources that are dependent on the climate.
We forget that we're living in such a dry country.
Dr. Ian Wright is a senior lecturer at Western Sydney University. He's an environmental scientist, and he says the rest of the country should look to Perth as a model for water supply.
Water Corporation of Western Australia are the absolute national leaders, and I think they are becoming international leaders in water conservation.
As Eastern Australia struggles under drought and water supplies tighten, Ian Wright believes recycled water could be a huge resource.
In Sydney, that's probably 150 litres per day per person of wastewater that's completely wasted. And yes, we have the availability of desalination on the coast, but Canberra doesn't have desalination. And then the poor drought-stricken towns like Tamworth and Dubbo and Broken Hill, they could really, really use that now.
It is doable, for sure.
Professor Jennifer Mackay from the University of South Australia's School of Law has spent the past 15 years investigating Australia's response to drought. She's sceptical about recycling water. She says the reason towns are running out of water is down to bad policy.
We have a messy mosaic of laws, and it's very hard for public servants and anybody to make sense of it. The solution is to simplify the thing we can, the laws, and then we would get some better thinking.
Professor Jennifer Mackay from the University of South Australia. Bridget Fitzgerald reporting from Perth. You probably take for granted the idea that you will know where your loved ones are buried. But for those living on Aboriginal land in the Northern Territory, there is no legal requirement to keep a register of people's burial plots. So that means many don't know where their ancestors were laid to rest. But there's now a push for those laws to be changed, as Kate Ashton reports.
They're a gravesite now, Sabi.
This is a significant moment for Isaac Pamkal.
By your grandpa.
Yeah, no, grandpa buried.
The 30-year-old is looking for his late father.
Today, special for me today, identifying where he's buried.
The final resting place is nestled between two gum trees at a cemetery in Burunga, a small Indigenous community about 4 hours southeast of Darwin. His father died when Isaac Pamkal was a child, and he's been looking for his burial plot for a long time.
Was asking for answers, and a lot of the old people who I asked, they mainly had sort of a memory loss.
It was made harder because there's no legal requirement to keep burial registers on Aboriginal land in the Northern Territory. Nell Brown is the Jungai, or Senior Traditional Custodian of Burunga, and she says it's a sad fact that there's no written records.
Yeah, it should be done a long time ago, you know, when family passing on, but nothing been done.
Many people in communities also struggle to afford a headstone, meaning potentially thousands of graves across the territory lie unregistered and unmarked.
Some family, they died a long time ago, and sometimes can't identify their.
To change this, a few years ago, Isaac Pamkal started working with archaeologists from Flinders University who are trying to create a register of who's buried where. But finding his own father's plot took the help of his mother, Wendy Williker. After a walk around the grass at the Burunga Cemetery, her memory is triggered and they find the spot between two gum trees.
And I remember that, I mean, that day now, but I remember what way he been buried.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think Isaac's father would be proud of him?
He would be proud of him, yeah.
Now there's legislation being proposed in the Territory that could prevent more people from going into unmarked graves on Aboriginal land. It would mean burial registers will have to be kept in Aboriginal communities. Flinders University archaeologist Jordan Ralph has been working in Burunga for a decade, and he says it would be a positive step.
Because it will provide some structure for the council or for the community to register those graves.
But he also wants government funding to help identify older graves.
It just means that the people that have been buried from the present back 50 years or more are just going to be forgotten.
In a statement, the NT government says councils are welcome to fund the work of finding older unmarked graves themselves. Isaac Pamkal is hoping to study archaeology next year so he can help others find lost graves.
Make sure we all remember who's buried where and that way we all can be happy.
Isaac Pamkal with reporter Kate Ashton. And that's PM. I'm Linda Mottram. You can find us at the ABC Listen app and wherever you get your podcasts. Do subscribe and do leave us a review. Bye-bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.